I think I'll win New York State. I think I'll win Michigan. I think I'll win states that nobody ever won before as a Republican for many years.
We intend to fight for every vote in front of us and for every delegate remaining.
When Heidi Cruz is first lady, French fries are coming back to the lunchroom.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09. This is May 2nd, 2016. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Welcome to another business day. Lots to talk to you about today, including your overnight market intel. And coming up, we're going to be talking with the head of the Humane Society of the United States, who's written a new book about the humane economy. We'll tell you all about that coming up. But right now, from the WGN Market Desk, here's your overnight global intel about what's happening in the world of business. Asian stock markets fell today as investors registered their disappointment over the lack of fresh stimulus in Japan and from the central bank there. The surge in the Japanese yen and bleak readings from a monthly factory managers survey did little to lighten the gloom. On Friday, the Dow Jones Industrials lost about 0.5%, 17,773. Standard & Poor's fell as well. The NASDAQ index lost about 0.5% as well. This morning, benchmark U.S. crude oil fell to above $45.50 a barrel. The dollar rose against the yen and fell against the euro. The business day ahead, two economic reports we'll be watching today that could be driving the markets. The Institute for Supply Management will release its manufacturing index for April. It'll tell us how much manufacturing is going on in the U.S. And the Commerce Department will report on construction spending in the U.S. during March. Here's a couple of stories you may have missed over the weekend. Tiny radio waves from your luggage could help find them when they get lost, if they get lost. Delta Airlines has announced it's going to be using a new identification system called RFID on your luggage. It's going to be starting at 84 airports, including Atlanta, where Delta is headquartered. The new RFID tag will be used instead of a barcode, easier to track lost luggage. If you're a fan of Dunkin' Donuts, you might want to download their app. The app will now let you order your donuts and coffee ahead of time. That was announced over the weekend as well. Some outdoor billboards have technology that can track you and your mobile phone. Clear Channel Outdoor America launched the so-called radar program earlier this year. Now, New York Senator Chuck Schumer is calling them spying billboards and warning they may violate people's privacy by tracking your cell phone data. Here's what he said at a news conference over the weekend.
Personal cell phone should be just that, personal. It shouldn't be a James Bond-like tracking device for a corporation. You should have to give them permission to follow you when you drive by or walk by a billboard.
Schumer's asking the Federal Trade Commission to create an opt-out for people passing by the billboards. Now, Clear Channel and the company that made these radar system billboards says that the characterization of the program is inaccurate, insisting they only use anonymous data collected by other companies. But during the Chipotle incident earlier this year, when Chipotle had all of those sick customers and was trying to figure out what was going on, those billboards were actually tracking people and whether or not they were using Chipotle restaurants. There are 675,000 of them throughout the country. Also, yesterday, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus's final 11 performing elephants marched into arenas for the last time in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and Providence, Rhode Island, ending a 145-year-old tradition of the giant elephants taking part in the Big Top.
The Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey!
For the past 145 years, they've dazzled as the giant stars of the greatest show on Earth.
And here come the elephants!
Under the Big Top and on the big screen. But the last 11 elephants still touring with the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus are preparing to walk into the ring one last time before going into retirement. Those elephants, the subject of decades of protests from animal rights groups, raising concerns about the use of bull hooks and quality of life in the circus. Other kinds of animals will remain a part of the show, but the pachyderms will join the circus's other 29 retired elephants at Ringling Center for Elephant Conservation in Florida, trading play and pageantry for rest and relaxation.
ABC News reporter in Pennsylvania reporting on those elephants. Human animal rights groups were successful in helping convince Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus to remove the elephants. Among those, the Humane Society of the United States, where Wayne Pacelli is the president and CEO, and he's written a new book called It's the Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And we're very happy to have Wayne on with us this morning on the Opening Bell. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning to you.
This is kind of a fits two pieces of the story together here, the elephants and your book. First, if you could talk to me about the elephants a bit.
Well, yes, as that piece you just ran indicates, 145 years of Ringling Brothers and elephants, and that ended yesterday. Not a lot of animals at risk, because we're talking only 40 or 50 elephants used by Ringling Brothers, but the symbolic significance is immense. Elephants were at the center of the brand of Ringling Brothers, and I think a lot of young people and a lot of people of every demographic starting to be concerned over these last few years with the treatment of the elephants. The company realized that that was going to be a drag on its future brand strength, as well as its revenues. And it said it's going to swap out the elephants for other sorts of entertainment. That is, you know, really what I talk about in my book, The Humane Economy, that businesses really have to marry their practices with the values of the country, especially when it comes to animal protection. And if they don't, if they have animal cruelty baked into the business model, there's going to be a risk. And of course, we just saw that SeaWorld made a major announcement and is ending the breeding of orcas. In my book, I really look at different sectors of the economy and how we're seeing changes in all of these different arenas, because now the public is alert to animal protection.
We're going to get into that more about that and how this is sort of transforming not only our country, but others as well. The book is called The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Markets ended April on a negative note, with the Dow Jones falling another 56 points on Friday to close at 17,775, while the S&P 500 fell 10 and the NASDAQ lost 29. Despite the disappointing finish to the week, both the Dow and the S&P 500 ended April with small gains. Nissan is recalling more than 3.5 million vehicles worldwide because the front passenger airbag might not work properly in a crash. About 600,000 Sentras are included in that recall. Puerto Rico's governor says his island will not pay most of the $470 million in debt payments due today. Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla says that making the entire payment would endanger basic necessities for people on Puerto Rico. Is that billboard you just passed spying on you? U.S. Senator Charles Schumer wants an investigation into the use of mobile phone data to learn about people who pass by billboards. Ads are catered to specific customers based on whether they visit advertiser stores. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. 521. The book is The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. The president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, Wayne Pacelli, is with us this morning. Wayne, you mentioned before we went to the break, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus and SeaWorld. But there really is a wave across the country of corporations and companies that had not been doing a good job with this area, doing a good job. Petco's, PetSmart. Talk to us about this wave of new animal welfareism, I guess.
Well, animal welfare has really moved from the margins into the mainstream, and companies in the realms of live entertainment with animals like Ringling and SeaWorld have changed, but so have cosmetics companies that are no longer testing on animals. I think one of the biggest changes is in the food retail sector. And, of course, Chicagoland is home to the headquarters of McDonald's. McDonald's 4 years ago said it won't, or it will phase out, its purchase of pork from farms that confine the pigs in small crates, so small that the animals can't even turn around. And then last September 2015, McDonald's said it's only going to source eggs from hen farms, from these large operations that raise hens for their eggs. that are outside of cages and ending the extreme confinement of the animals on battery cages. Since McDonald's made the second announcement on the eggs and when they made the announcement on the pigs, more than 150 of the biggest brand names in food, I mean, you name it, Burger King and Hardee's and Carl's Jr., food service companies like Sodexo and Aramark, big box stores like Walmart and Target, and then groceries like Kroger and Safeway, they've all said they're going to stop sourcing their animal products from farms that confine the animals so severely. This is a huge development because so many billions of animals are raised in our food production system. And on these factory farms, it's been just routine and customary to have them in these small cages and crates. So we're seeing these things happening with animal issues and with these big companies. And it marked a real tipping point, I think, in our society when it comes to the treatment of animals.
Well, you and others have spent your lives working on making this happen, really. This is what you do. Is there something that you can put your finger on that changes this? Why now? Why are people now suddenly, you know, taking, I mean, after SeaWorld, the response to that was amazing. People are demanding these cage-free eggs. People are demanding that these companies stop doing what they're doing. What's done this to them? Why are they changing their minds like this all of a sudden or becoming active?
Well, I try to articulate the reasons for this in my book, The Humane Economy. But suffice to say that the underlying explanation, given that this is happening in different sectors of the economy, food and agriculture, science and testing, wildlife management, use of animals in live entertainment, fashion, is because there's just a growing consciousness about animals. There's, number one, a recognition that animal cruelty is wrong. Two, that animals think and feel. And that third, we've got new technologies, and we humans have this incredible ability to be innovative and to exhibit ingenuity. We can find new ways to do things. I mean, think of entertainment. Ringling gives up elephants partly because Cirque du Soleil and so many other forms of live entertainment now use human acrobats, and they entertain people without making victims of any animals. Think of cosmetic testing on animals. I mean, we used to poison animals by the millions for safety tests for the compounds and the chemicals used in cosmetic testing. Now we know to use safe ingredients, or we have 21st century technologies that are much more reliable, faster, in terms of doing that safety testing. So we're seeing these changes across the board with these multiple explanations, and the confluence of these factors is really leading us to a new future in our human relationship with animals.
What are the challenges that lie ahead for organizations like yours? There are still people out there who obviously haven't gotten this message yet. What are your new challenges?
Well, they're just a dizzying array of problems that we confront at the Humane Society of the United States. And while we celebrate these gains, we're by no means doing a victory lap. The world is still a very rough place for so many animals. And, you know, at the end of my book, I talk about, you know, joining groups like the Humane Society of the United States, because through our collective action, we can make change in so many different areas. I think we still have to think about the food issue. I mean, we raise 9 billion animals for food every year, and we just can't raise this many animals humanely and sustainably. We've got to drive down euthanasia rates further for companion animals. We're still euthanizing 2.5 million dogs and cats a year. So many big problems with wildlife and wildlife management. I hope people take a look at the book. I'll be in Chicagoland tomorrow on May 3rd at the Lincoln Park Zoo. Folks can go to humaneeconomy.org and get details and get a ticket for tonight's event, tomorrow night's event at 6 p.m.
Wayne Pacelli, the head of the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. The name of the book, again, is The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Wayne, good book. Thank you for being with us this morning.
So glad to be with you. Thank you.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. There are legacy cities whose economies are in decline and expansive cities where population and economies are growing. Which one is Chicago, and why does our future depend on leaders making the right choices now? There's a new study out trying to answer those questions. It's been put together by Dr. Issy Romim, the chief economist at BuildZoom.com, who's with us this morning via Skype from California. Dr. Romim, has the expansion of cities slowed down? Is that something accurate we can say?
It's not accurate. Depends on how you look at things. American cities as a whole have not slowed down in terms of their expansion. They're still expanding at the same rate they have been since roughly the 1950s, which is about 10,000 square miles per decade. That was a bit higher in the 70s and is slightly lower now, but on the whole, it's been pretty flat. What's new is that cities are diverging into two groups, and they have been since roughly the early 70s or late 60s. One group is one that I call the expensive cities. These are cities like San Francisco and New York and Boston, expensive coastal cities where expansion has been slowing down. And partially as a result of that, housing prices have been going up. The other group of cities is the one I call expansive. These are cities whose economies are also doing well, but they have not stopped growing outward. They don't have the anti-sprawl bias that's present in some of the other cities. And they, some of them are even expanding faster than they used to. And this group is balancing out the first one so that on average, American cities are expanding at the same rate.
So give us an example of what city, a city that would be in both of these categories and why you characterize it as being in that category.
So San Francisco is the extreme example of a city in the expensive cities category. And it has three things going on which cause it to be there. And before I list those three, just to be clear, when I say San Francisco or Chicago, what I really mean are the larger metro areas. San Francisco is just code for the Bay Area, all the way from far south of San Jose to wine country up in the north. San Francisco has a very strong economy. It's got Silicon Valley, which is perhaps the powerhouse economy in the country right now. At the same time, it's got a very limiting geography. It's surrounded by water bodies and mountains that prevent easy expansion outwards. These aren't areas where you can't build per se, but these are areas where you can't build subdivisions easily at low cost the way you can on flat or mildly hilly land. The third thing it has going for it is a very strong ecological mindset. This is sort of the birthplace of the environmentalist movement in the 60s, and that means that there's a lot more protection on open land and agricultural land here than there is in most places in the country. Those three things together mean that there's a very strong demand for people to live here. A lot of people want to move here, and people who are capable of paying a lot, and there's not an opportunity to build housing as easily as there is elsewhere, either through outward expansion into new land or through densification, which is more limited than it is elsewhere for reasons that have to do with a whole slew of factors. I shouldn't list that. That's beyond this question.
So let's talk about Chicago. Where does Chicago fall in this mix?
Chicago is sort of in the middle. So there's a third group of cities that I didn't mention. If there's expensive on one end and expansive on the other, these are two groups that have healthy economies. There's a third group that I've dubbed legacy cities, whose poster child is Detroit. Cities that are suffering from all the problems that people associate with the Rust Belt. They basically don't have strong economies that draw people in, but they've got real estate, they've got properties that are already built, and real estate takes a lot of time to degrade. It stays around, and that means that people can live there for much lower costs, and that keeps people there. Chicago is kind of in the middle between being an expensive city and being a legacy city. I've heard people say that Chicago is one-third San Francisco and two-thirds Detroit, and that, at least according to its location on the chart in the report seems to be pretty much true. Downtown Chicago and perhaps the northern parts of the metro area, or perhaps in some other directions as well, seem to behave like some of the more expensive cities, whereas other parts of the metro area, and my guess would be that that's to the south and the southeast, are behaving more like Rust Belt cities.
And what are the side effects of this? Are there construction jobs? Are there booming economies? Is it costing people more to live in these places? Give us some of the effects and side effects.
Well, my guess is that it matters a lot depending on where in the city you want to live. I'm not an expert on Chicago. I don't want to pretend to be. But my guess would be that in downtown areas that are very attractive to people because they're walkable, because they're exciting, because there's all these social amenities there, and it's possible to lead an urban lifestyle there, those areas are probably becoming much more expensive than they would be otherwise. And my guess is that there are limitations on how easy it is to expand housing in those areas. There are probably parts of downtown Chicago where there's no problem authorizing a new skyscraper, but there are probably many other large swaths of the city where these are walkable, dense areas, but where it's not easy to get permission to expand the housing supply a lot, where you actually have to fight battles with local opponents of construction, and that prevents those places from developing more houses and from relaxing their housing price growth. In other parts of the city, which are less attractive in this respect, it's probably much easier to buy a large house and have enough bedrooms for all your children without going overboard. You probably don't see the situation that you see here in the Bay Area or in some East Coast cities, where even folks who earn well and have two salaries per household don't really have a hope of buying a home in the foreseeable future. It's probably easier to buy a home in the outer parts or in suburban Chicago, especially if you head to the parts that are not doing as well. That's not rocket science, though.
So you say that Chicago is right on the intersection of expensive and legacy cities. What would push us over, and what would the impact of that be on the city?
Well, I think developing new sectors in the economy, sectors that attract workers with certain types of skill sets, STEM workers and such, would help the economy. Chicago has some of those, especially in finance, but growing a stronger tech sector in Chicago would probably help push Chicago towards the expensive quadrant of the map. I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. I think there's something to be said for being either expensive or expansive, or in between the two. Either of those are manifestations of a healthy economy.
We're on the phone with on Skype this morning with Dr. Issy Roman, chief economist at buildzoom.com, talking about the expansion of American cities.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
550 on the market desk this morning. Dow Jones futures, S&P futures, NASDAQ futures, all just a little bit higher this morning, indicating a positive open on Wall Street. Let's get the latest on commodities now. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. And let me begin by saying thank you to the 600 people who joined us in Racine on Saturday night for the Racine 20-Year Club Banquet of CNH Industrial. That's the company that started out years ago as International Harvester and Farmall, but a lot of WGN listeners in that group, and we enjoyed our visit to Racine very much. The quick look at headlines, since these happened last Friday: corn, soybeans, wheat closed firm, and all three commodities showed gains for the month of April. Meanwhile, live cattle futures closed higher but came off the highs before trade ended on Friday, and Midwest cash hog prices traded mostly steady to end the trading week. A reminder, tonight at the Morris Community High School front gym in Morris, Illinois, Great Lakes Basin Transportation Company. That's the company that wants to build a 275-mile railroad that would cut through a large number of farms in 7 Illinois counties, 3 in Indiana, and 1 in Wisconsin, plus building a massive intermodal rail yard estimated to take about 15,000 acres in northern Kankakee County. Well, Frank Patton, managing partner of Great Lakes Basin Transportation, will be at the meeting tonight to go over the maps and then to answer questions about the future of that project. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. 5:52. We are talking with Dr. Issy Roman this morning, the chief economist at BuildZoom.com, about expanding cities and legacy cities. Dr. Roman is with us on Skype this morning. So can we attribute the loss of population in Chicago to any of the factors that you've outlined in your research?
I think it would. I think the parts of Chicago that look more like legacy cities are probably losing population for the same reasons as other legacy cities, lack of opportunity. And the parts of Chicago that behave more like expensive cities are doing the same thing that other expensive cities are doing, which is churning their population. You have typically net inflows of population at higher income levels. If I think of California as a whole as the example, I've seen one study by Jed Kolko, Trulia's former chief economist, that shows that above $200,000 per year of household income, you see net in-migration to California. And below that level, you see net out-migration, which is another way of saying that the middle class is the one that's being pushed out. And that could be happening in certain parts of Chicago. Again, I'm not an expert on Chicago per se, so I'm hesitant to say that. I've not looked at the numbers, but that could very well be the case in parts of Chicago.
And so do you see cities that are these legacy cities that are possibly in decline, focusing on things that will push them in the other direction? Like, for instance, in Chicago, we have a focus on attracting high-tech jobs and innovation and technology, that sorts of thing. Do you see cities trying to reinvent themselves?
I imagine that just about every city is trying to do that to some extent. Typically, local business organizations and City Hall itself, at least of the main city that leads the region, will try and create a stir or some hype about the local economy to try and attract businesses. I don't know how successful those movements are. Cities' economic structures tend to be very long lasting. Movements in this sphere are slow, and the places where local government is capable of doing things usually has to do with attracting some single large investment, usually by giving some tax break. And those big, let's call them million-dollar factories or multi-million-dollar factories that local governments are sometimes able to bring in tend to be more detached from the local economy just by because of their sheer volume. What cities really need to do is build a healthy organic economy that produces small businesses that grow into larger ones, not to import one large company that comes in. And that's a much harder thing to do. But there are policies that are aimed towards that. There are tech incubators that help founders of new companies do a better job, give them some resources, some legal aid, some advice, some office space. Just a social environment to be with one another. And those things probably do have some effect. You see that working in North Carolina in some places. I know that exists in Denver. I know that there's the National Association of Realtors tries to help startups in the real estate space, and they sit in Chicago. So my guess is that's going on there. Those things can help. Can they change the picture dramatically? Not so easily. There's a reason Silicon Valley has been where it is for decades now, and there's a reason that finance stays in New York, and those are things that are just very hard to shift.
You would like to see more study done of this. What areas would you like more study done? What particularly would you like to find out?
Well, where I plan to go with this next is to get an idea of whether this expansive versus expensive dynamic exists within cities, across neighborhoods. Obviously, expansive would look different when you think of it at a neighborhood level. It would be more about areas that are capable of densifying versus areas that are less capable of densifying. But I have a hunch that the same dynamic exists within metro areas at the neighborhood level, and I plan on looking at that. Regardless of what I plan to do, I think that something that is very much called for these days is to look into the vast set of local policies and regulations that prohibit densification. Some of the most productive cities in the country are held back by their inability to produce more housing. And that's because of a long list of local rules that have been accrued over time, which prevent these cities from building more. And it's not easy to pinpoint what these rules are. And I'll give you an example. I heard recently that one of the cities here in the Bay Area has a rule that says to vote on certain land use matters, one has to show up at a certain meeting in person. That sounds innocuous, right? But what it actually means is that anyone who has a full-time job, is raising children, or basically doesn't have a lot of free time on their hands, can't come to vote, which means that folks who are retired, who tend to, who are more likely to have certain views on new construction because they're likely to own property in the area or because they're of a certain mindset, are much likelier to be able to represent themselves at meetings like that. So that's just an example of an innocuous rule that no one would think matters for these issues, but it actually helps, on average, prevent densification, or at least that would be my guess. Putting together a list of all these rules, figuring out which of them matters and how to change them, I think is a very important thing to look at. And I think it's getting a lot more attention now, especially since the White House called for land use reform a few months ago.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Dr. Issy Roman, the chief economist. You can read more at buildzoom.com. Thanks for being with us this morning. That's the opening bell. We'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock.